Have you heard of the Minnesota Iceman, the White Bluff Screamer? How about the Texas T-Rex? And, of course, you've heard about Bigfoot. Well, you're going to hear about all of them in a moment. Ken Gerhardt back with us on Coast to Coast, and we will be back talking about cryptids on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. George Norrie with you, along with Ken Gerhardt back with us. One of his works is called The Essential Guide to Bigfoot. Ken is a widely recognized cryptozoologist and field investigator for the Center of Fortean Zoology and the Gulf Coast Bigfoot Research Organization, as well as a fellow of the Pangea Institute and a consultant for lots of paranormal groups. He has searched for evidence of mysterious animals and legendary beasts around the world, including Bigfoot, the Loch Ness Monster, the Chupacabra, the giant winged creatures, and even werewolves. Ken, I'm going to have fun talking to you tonight, and welcome back.
Good evening, George. It's always an honor to speak with you, my friend.
Are you ready for Thanksgiving?
Always.
Super. Super. I can't believe how fast this year's going, Kenny.
It is flying right by, yes, but I am ready for the gluttony of Thanksgiving.
Super. What is it that got you interested in crypto?
Man, I've been obsessed with cryptozoology since I was a young boy, and I grew up in a family that was already sort of indoctrinated with science and animals, but we loved monsters in my household. But when I found out about Bigfoot as a young boy, I was just hooked. And, of course, I saw the famous Patterson-Gimlin Bigfoot film around that time in the 70s. And I've just been very fortunate in my life. I've had an opportunity to travel and investigate these things. I've never had a sighting myself, and, of course, people always ask me that. However, I believe that I have been in close proximity to these creatures. I've heard them vocalize, and I've, of course, interviewed hundreds of people that have had encounters. So cryptozoology is just a... It's a very in-depth field. You know, most people have heard of Bigfoot and the Loch Ness Monster and Mothman, but there's a host of other mysterious creatures, lesser-known creatures that people have reported, giant snakes and living pterodactyls and thunderbirds and black panthers. And so there are a lot of these things, cryptids we call them, animals that have avoided scientific detection still lurking out there in the wilderness, I believe.
When I first got really excited about the crypto end of all of this, it was in school, grade school, when I was reading about the abominable snowman in the Himalayas. And I got to believe that that's similar to Bigfoot in such a ways, even though the abominable snowman was always like white-haired. We don't hear too much about that anymore. How come?
Well, you know, first of all, I think there's a little bit of a misconception. I think, you know, the white-haired Yeti is something that we've kind of drawn from our different cultural influences. So most of the sightings, in fact, describe a creature that has kind of got brownish, reddish fur. And the belief that they live primarily in the snow is probably also a misperception. They probably, in fact, inhabit the temperate valleys, the mountain valleys that are well forested. And we find their footprints, of course, as they travel from valley to valley in the snow. I think there are sightings still in that area. I have some colleagues that have gone over there and done research, primarily not only in the Himalayas, but areas of northern India, where they're known as the Mande Burung, Bhutan, where it's called the Migo, similar types of creatures. But one interesting thing about the Yeti that a lot of people don't realize, George, is that most descriptions of the Yeti characterize it as a much smaller creature than Bigfoot. In fact, most sightings describe a being that's only about 4 to 5 feet tall, still very powerful and very terrifying to the local Sherpa people. It could be related to Bigfoot, but it seems to be a smaller version.
You know, you're right, because in those earlier articles that I would read as a kid, it wasn't that big. It was, maybe a little shorter than an ape.
Yeah, but still walks upright like a man, which is significant. And apparently very aggressive. There are many accounts of it attacking people, killing yaks, and so on and so forth. So seemingly more aggressive than the North American Bigfoot or Sasquatch.
I can't remember, Ken, at what point I started realizing the Bigfoot Sasquatch stories here. But when I first started hearing about them, it really sparked my interest. And I believe a lot of these cases came from the Northwest. Is that correct?
Yes. The vast majority of accounts stem from Washington State, Oregon, Northern California. We also, of course, have a lot of sightings from British Columbia and Alaska. So the Pacific coastal ranges, the Cascade ranges, produce the vast majority of sightings. However, we do have a healthy number of accounts stemming from places in the eastern United States. Curiously, states like Florida, where it's known as the skunk ape, Pennsylvania and Ohio boast a lot of sightings, Texas, where I live, and Oklahoma, Louisiana, many of the southern states. In fact, in recent years, it seems like we've been getting a lot of sightings out of places like Kentucky, North Carolina, and Georgia, and so on and so forth. So whatever these things are, they seem to be primarily focused or inhabiting the Pacific Northwest, but there may be sort of nomadic individuals that are roaming across the country.
Like UFO stories of the past, a lot of people who would report these kind of sightings were looked at with some kind of weary eye. I think nowadays people take these pretty seriously, don't they?
You know, I think it's there have been some scientists that have gotten involved through the years, and I think that's been kind of really helpful to the field of cryptozoology in general. You know, I work with a few PhDs that are at least curious in the subject, though, of course, they're still reticent about becoming too involved because it, you know, it's still looked upon as a dubious thing when you're a scientist and you're getting involved with things like Bigfoot and UFOs, unfortunately. But I think more people have taken the matters more seriously. Now, this is interesting, George. The vast majority of people, about 80 to 82% of the people population, does not think that Bigfoot could exist. They still like Bigfoot, of course. They buy Bigfoot on in the form of toys and foods and things. Only about 18 to 22% of the population believes that Bigfoot could exist, but I think that number is probably even larger. I think most people wouldn't want to admit that they, you know, that something like Bigfoot could exist. But when you consider the vast wilderness areas in our planet that are still unexplored and, you know, new species are still being found all the time, I think there's a lot of promise there.
Well, you know, and that statistic is much lower than what ufologists would say about UFOs and extraterrestrial contact. You would think that the Bigfoot people would echo the UFO people, and that would be about the same, but I guess not.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's a lot to be learned about human perception and different cultural influences and things. You know, a lot of the UFO thing may have come through conditioning. You know, through the years, we've of course been exposed to, you know, a number of science fiction movies and government and, you know, mounted investigations like Project Blue Book that I think gave the UFO thing a lot of credibility, particularly early on. Bigfoot has always kind of been struggling. Bigfoot researchers have always kind of struggled in the wings in terms of trying to get the attention, you know, that the UFO field gets in terms of, like, scientific interest and so forth.
Could you say categorically at this point that Bigfoot does exist?
George, what I always tell people is that I've been investigating the Bigfoot phenomenon for over four decades. I'm 90% convinced that they exist. I always leave that 10% of wiggle room since I haven't seen one with my own eyes.
Right.
But there is literally a mountain of evidence in terms of thousands of documented eyewitness reports, the Patterson-Gimlin Bigfoot film, footprints that have been found, documented, photographed, and cast in plaster, and we have a number of those, and they have a lot of very compelling features. Some hair samples, vocalizations, I've heard a number of those that I couldn't explain. Native American legends that date back centuries that are very consistent with modern sightings. And I think when you put that all together, I think it builds a very strong case. And the last thing that I think people need to keep in mind is that things like Bigfoot actually did exist on our planet. We know this from our fossil history. You know, for 2 million years, there were these presumably hair-covered man-like hominids roaming all over the planet, many different species of things that looked just like Bigfoot, and we found their fossils. So it's just a little bit of a stretch of the imagination to assume that maybe some of these ancient species have survived in small numbers into modern times, and we just haven't found them yet.
Well, and if you believe the Darwin evolutionary theory, I would think that the Bigfoot Sasquatch influence could be the missing link between ape and man. What do you think?
Well, you know, it's a bushy tree. We know that. So that's one thing we're finding in paleoanthropology is that the human tree keeps growing into this big shaggy bush, and there were all kinds of different offshoots. One thing, of course, that's very notable is that Bigfoot has a locomotor system very similar to us, right? It walks with cross-limb coordination. It takes big steps. It swings its arms. It has broad shoulders. So, I mean, that's remarkable that it seems to move very much like humans. And presumably they're very intelligent. I think that's one of the reasons we haven't been able to find them yet, is that they're smart enough to know that they don't want to be found by us. And also many people that have had close-up sightings have described their faces as looking very, very human-like. When you add all that together, I think you could consider that it is definitely a hominin, something very, very close to us in the hominin line.
How tall do they get, Ken?
That's a good question, because there's a lot of stories out there of people reporting Bigfoot 10, 12, 15 feet tall. Now, first thing we have to recognize, George, is that people are actually very bad sometimes at estimating the sizes of things, particularly things that are startling to them, right, that really shock them and get their adrenaline pumping. But we have the benefit of thousands of Bigfoot sightings, and when we put them all together, a very consistent model emerges, and some studies have been done analyzing that data. And the average height for a Bigfoot, as turns out, based on eyewitness estimates, is about 7.5 feet tall. The subject in the Patterson-Gimlin Bigfoot film, which is called, we call her Patty because she has big pendulous hair-covered breasts that you can see in the film, so we know she's a female. There have been a number of academic studies on the film, and the conclusion there is that she stands about 7'3" tall. That's the consensus. And if we assume that she's a female because she has breasts, then she would be a little bit smaller than the males, because all hominids, including humans and great apes, are sexually dimorphic. That is, the males are a little bit larger than the females. So in my own opinion, George, the males can get to be about 8 feet tall, maybe 9 feet tall on a really big one, and they probably weigh between 500 to 1,000 pounds.
That's a pretty good size.
Yeah, they're big. they are true giants, based on that. I personally discount accounts of them standing any taller than 9 feet tall.
Just tuning in, we're talking with Ken Gerhardt about cryptozoology. Several of his books include The Essential Guide to Bigfoot, A Menagerie of Mysterious Beasts, Encounters with Flying Humanoids, Mothman, Manbirds, Gargoyles, and Other Winged Beasts, also Big Bird and Monsters of Texas as well. These creatures, and we'll get into some of the other creatures later on in the program, Ken, but what do you think the Bigfoot population could be in just North America?
Yeah, well, that's another great question, because if these things exist, there has to be a viable breeding population, right? I mean, that's a true biological law. You look at any species, you have to have genetic variation and so on and so forth. So based on the range of a specific Bigfoot individual whose tracks were identified by a physical anthropologist in different locations, we were able to estimate that a Bigfoot or a Sasquatch might have a pretty wide range, probably about 1,000 square mile range. And when you extrapolate that across North America, it actually calculates out to about 4,000 individuals. Now, there's been another study that also came up with 4,000. Now, this is just speculation, but I mean, if you think about 4,000 spread across all of the continental North America, from Alaska, Canada, through the United States, it's still a very, very rare animal, in my own opinion. 4,000 just gives it just enough genetic viability to have a breeding population and, to have been around a very long time. But of course, again, it's all speculation. The numbers may be a bit lower. But the important thing that people need to remember is that if Bigfoot does exist, their population has to, at the very least, be in the low thousands. Otherwise, it would be impossible. It would go extinct.
And compared to, let's say, like deer population across North America, which has got to be into the hundreds of thousands, I would guess.
Oh, yeah. And, the analogy we use typically is the bear population. And Bigfoot seems to have a lot in common with bears in terms of diet, behavior patterns, habitat, and so forth. So there are about 400,000 bears, I believe, in North America. So there's about 1,000 bears for every Bigfoot, which is, I think, one of the reasons that we haven't been able to find, physical evidence of them, because they're just exceptionally rare creatures.
Or we haven't gotten that great photograph either. Now, we'll get into the Patterson-Gimlin film in a second, but we really haven't gotten the great photos, have we?
Not really, and that's a very surprising thing. I think that's ammunition for the skeptics. You know, when you consider how many cameras are out there, not just cell phones, but also, you know, the trail cameras that are stationary cameras and surveillance cameras and things that are set up all over the place these days. There are, of course, still alleged photographs and videos that come in on a regular basis. Most of those are unfortunately too grainy or out of focus, or there's just not enough detail and clarity to make a determination. So I'm getting kind of frustrated personally in terms of you know, using photographic evidence as a potential avenue. But you know, there are theories that, you know, perhaps again Bigfoot has certain abilities, and not to paint it as a supernatural thing, but just, you know, as all animals have really remarkable abilities and adaptations, Bigfoot may be able to sense things like trail cameras, because trail cameras, of course, are electronic. They give off electromagnetic energy and impulses and frequencies, and some animals are able to detect those electromagnetic frequencies. Sharks, for example, are very good at sensing electromagnetic energy. So, you know, perhaps Bigfoot, one of his adaptations may be avoiding technology, you know, something mm-hmm. that associates with humankind.
Some people have said, Ken, that Bigfoot is dimensional. I tend to think if it's real, it's physical. How about you?
Yeah, I'm not a huge proponent of the interdimensional theories. I understand, you know, one of the strong arguments for that is, you know, what we're just discussing, which is the lack of solid photographic evidence, the lack of physical remains, a body, a bone, or anything like that. It is baffling that we don't have better evidence at this point. Now, it's true that there are some really weird accounts that relate to Bigfoot, mostly stemming from places like Pennsylvania in the Midwest, that describe Bigfoot vanishing into thin air or trackways that stop in the middle of nowhere. But if you look at the entire database of sightings, again, numbering in the thousands, the really, really weird, quote-unquote, interdimensional accounts, I would say make up less than 1% of the total percentage of sightings. So in my mind, I just don't think there's just enough evidence, you know, to make a case for that.
Some years ago, about 11 years ago, a couple people, including a police officer, put their careers on the line, claimed that they had a captured Bigfoot, when instead it was a rubber costume, and I think they stuffed it with deer guts or something like that. How frustrating is stuff like that, Ken, for someone like you who does some real hard research?
Oh, yeah, that's a big one of the greatest challenges in Bigfoot research is dealing with the hoaxing. And it's nothing new, of course. There have been Bigfoot hoaxers dating back to the 1950s and possibly before. These guys were strapping like big wooden footprint cutting cookie cutter
and just stamping them,
stomping around in the woods and leaving footprints. People faking films, and you know, of course, with the availability of great technology now, that's the thing, you know, with things like Photoshop and video editing software, and, you know, it's easier for people, I think, to sort of fake things. And, it's a challenge, George. A lot of people, I think, are in it for the money, frankly. Other people just trying to get attention or trying to fool others. But it does cast kind of a dubious shadow over the entire Bigfoot field when these hoaxes get exposed. It sort of gives the skeptics more ammunition to say, well, you know, it's all just kind of foolishness.
Yeah, indeed. We've got Ken's link to his Facebook page at coasttocoastam.com. We will be back in a moment. Next hour, we'll take phone calls. Still, there are other cryptids we want to talk about as well, including Bigfoot still, including the Minnesota Iceman, the White Bluff Screamer, and how about that Texas T-Rex? What the heck are these things? We'll be back. And welcome back to Coast. George Norrie back with you, along with Ken Gerhardt, as we're talking about his incredible work into the cryptid field. He's a cryptozoologist indeed. The Patterson-Gimlin Bigfoot film that all of us have probably have seen. Ken, your thoughts about that?
Well, George, I'm convinced, I've always been convinced that it's real. But one thing that's interesting is that as the technology is getting better, prints of the film are being digitized and stabilized and enhanced.
Mm-hmm.
And to my own eye, I mean, it's looking even more and more real than it ever has. I mean, you can actually see muscle masses moving. You can see skin folds. there appears to be a type of herniation on one of the quadriceps that's kind of flapping back and forth. The breasts look very natural and flowy. So, I mean, if you consider, and the argument has always been, you know, that it was a man in a costume, but if you look at the costume technology of the of that time period, the film was shot on October 20th, 1967, ape costumes in the 1960s were just not very good, period. They were kind of these big,
right,
you know, puffy things. Look at Planet of the Apes type stuff. So, you know, where did this guy get the technology, or where did these guys get the technology, presumably, to fake this thing back in 1967? The other two things, there's other two other lines of evidence that people overlook. One is Bob Gimlin, who's still alive, who was there when it was filmed. Roger Patterson did the filming, but his buddy Bob Gimlin was standing by with a rifle. And, you know, these guys were on horseback when they rode up on this thing. Bob is still alive. I've gotten to know him well. I've heard him tell the story multiple times over 15 years. He's never deviated one iota from this description of that day. And it should be noted that Bob didn't even believe Bigfoot existed when they rode up on this thing. He was a skeptic. Roger had kind of dragged him out there in the woods to look for this thing. And when he saw it, he was just, you know, his mind was blown. But the last thing is that there was a trackway left behind. A lot of people don't know this, but the subject in the film left behind a trackway. That trackway was very deep. The stride was very enormous. And up to six different individuals studied, photographed, and cast that trackway over a 16-day period after the filming. And those are some of the best Bigfoot footprints that have been found and studied. They are very natural. They show dynamics. That is, you know, with each step, there's a different impression. The dirt's kicked a certain way, or there's different pressure points. So, you know, how in the name of, did these guys not only fake a guy in a costume so convincingly, but how would they have also accomplished faking this incredibly genuine-looking trackway that, again, has been studied by physical anthropologists? So, you know, when you put it all together, I think it builds a very, very strong case. And, you know, where's the costume? You know, that's the last thing I'll say.
Exactly.
All these people through the years have claimed that it was a costume. Well, no one's ever produced said costume, you know, so.
Well, and you always have to look at who benefits, and they didn't really make a lot of money with this, did they?
No, not at all. In fact, Roger Patterson, sadly, was dying of Hodgkin's disease at the time, and he could have made a fortune, for example, if he had admitted it was a hoax and come forward, but he never did that. In fact, he spent his last years in the early 70s, the little bit of money he did make from the Patterson film, Gimlin film, he was using to try to pursue a story about a Bigfoot that was trapped in a cave somewhere in Asia. Bob Gimlin never made more than $10. He kind of got shafted on the whole deal. So there was a little bit of money made, but certainly not the fortune it could have been if it had been exposed as one of the world's greatest hoaxes.
Did Gimlin, who was there on a horse with his rifle, ever think of shooting that Bigfoot?
No, this is interesting. Evidently, Patterson and Gimlin had talked about the fact that if they did come across a Bigfoot, and keep in mind they were in a specific area for a reason. There had been footprints found there very recently, and there had been a lot of footprints found through the years.
Right. They were looking for Bigfoot, weren't they?
They were looking for Bigfoot. Yeah. They were on horseback. These were, you know, outdoorsmen. But they had discussed the fact that they would only shoot it if they came across a Bigfoot, they would only shoot it if it came at them in an aggressive fashion.
Mm-hmm.
And as you can see by watching the film, the Bigfoot simply turns and walks away very quickly, looking over its shoulder, glancing back at one point to make sure it wasn't being followed. So Bob had the rifle got off his horse, and he had the rifle kind of at his side, but he didn't really aim it consider taking a shot at the thing. So,
whatever happened with the work of Dr. Melba Kitchum?
Very controversial, of course. A lot of it has been debunked. A lot of misinformation there. And in fact, a good friend of mine, Dr. Haskell Hart, who's a chemist, undertook a peer review of her work, her paper, and quite honestly, he kind of tore it to shreds in terms of her methodology and so forth. Now, I don't pretend to be a geneticist, but in essence, what she was claiming was hybrid DNA, that is a cross between a human and some type of ancient hominid was fairly baseless. The four main samples, I think, that they put up as examples turned out to be bears, and one was contaminated by human DNA, evidently, and that may have been one of the reasons that there were reports that, Bigfoot had human DNA, because as you can imagine, collecting DNA in the wilderness, there's a high risk for contamination by whoever's collecting it. So sadly, there have been a number of DNA studies attempted on alleged Bigfoot skin tissue, hairs, and so on and so forth, but all of those have come back as known animals, bears, different types of ungulates, goats, deer, and so on and so forth. So there's still no DNA evidence that Bigfoot exists.
Ken, I haven't heard of any organized scientific group from government trying to look for Bigfoot. Is there something going on clandestinely that we should be aware of?
George, it's hard to say. I like to think that there are good reasons why the government would want to keep Bigfoot a secret. I mean, if you can imagine, if they were to come out and announce that there was a race of 9-foot-tall, hairy, human-like creatures running around North America, it would probably create widespread panic on a massive scale.
It could, yeah.
Vigilantes, who knows what would...
Yahoos would go out there and shoot them up, right?
Yeah, the Yahoos, and, it would rock the foundation of our society. There's no doubt about it. So there's certainly a strong reason that the government, if they had evidence, would suppress it. Now, a couple of interesting things. Earlier this year, in fact, the FBI released declassified some files. They had actually tested some alleged Bigfoot hairs back in the 1970s. So, this is not well known, but the FBI did, in fact, they were submitted some hairs by a gentleman named Peter Byrne, who was a Bigfoot investigator from California. They did a study on the hairs, and they found out that they claimed that the hairs actually belonged to some type of deer species. I guess we'll never know if that's the actual case. But what's interesting is that I've actually come across, I interviewed one gentleman who was retired from the Army. And he swore to me that when he was doing his basic training in Georgia, I forget the name of the fort, but it was a wooded area, he says that their training field manual actually had explicit instructions on how to deal with a Bigfoot if you were to encounter one in the woods. And it was basically how to avoid conflict and so on and so forth. So I've never actually seen this document, but, that's just one example. But through the years, I've heard different claims like that there are different sort of classified documents and military field guides and things that may reference Bigfoot as if it's a real animal. So,
interesting. That could be Fort Benning down there.
Yeah, that was it, Fort Benning.
Yeah.
So I'm certainly open-minded to the possibility that the government knows more than they're telling us. But I'm not a proponent of the conspiracy theories that state that there's a Bigfoot body being kept in a secret underground bunker somewhere.
I haven't heard of Bigfoot attacking anybody. Have you?
There's a famous account from Washington State, the Ape Canyon incident. It occurred way back in 1924. And in fact, just recently, a researcher named Mark Marcel has rediscovered the location. It's a famous story in the Bigfoot field. But
what happened?
Five miners were on a location called Ape Canyon, right in the shadow of Mount St. Helens, and they began to find evidence of Bigfoot footprints on the Sandy Creek bed. First, they thought they might belong to a giant Indian or somebody, mm-hmm. Bigfoot, but these were huge footprints, and they finally saw these what were called at that time mountain devils. This was before the word Bigfoot had entered the public vernacular. They took some shots at the thing. And they apparently shot one of these Bigfoot creatures, and it fell off a crevasse into a creek below. And consequently, their cabin was attacked by a group of...
Well, Bigfoot. That's more of a defense, though, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. So I don't, I think we should respect Bigfoot as a large animal. I mean, we're talking about something that's 9 feet tall, presumably. A very dangerous animal, but
exactly.
I don't think they're aggressive towards humans.
Now, what is the Minnesota Iceman story? We've all heard different pieces of that.
Well, the Minnesota Iceman is a very famous case. And first of all, I have to acknowledge that it has a lot of importance to me personally because I saw the thing back in 1976 when I was growing up in Minnesota.
In ice?
Yes, it was in ice.
Yeah.
as the name states, is a creature, a human-like creature, covered in hair, about 6.5 feet tall. And it was in an ice block, and it was being toured around to different carnivals and sideshows around North America.
And very quickly, did it look like the Sasquatch that people have been reporting?
It did in some ways. I mean, it looked sort of like a mixture of human and ape-like characteristics.
Okay, but it didn't look like the Sasquatch that we've heard so much about.
It didn't look like Patty in the Patterson-Gimlin
right.
film.
Right, okay, okay.
Kind of like a caveman type thing, but covered in hair, very robust and muscular. And this thing was studied by two scientists back in 1968 through the ice. They didn't get to the owner of the thing, a guy named Frank Hansen, would not melt the ice down. They were convinced the thing was real. And this was mainly based on a smell of putrefaction that they could detect coming up through the ice. They could actually see gaseous bubbles in the ice that indicated the carcass was rotting.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay.
The one I saw in 1976, I think, was a latex model. And that's where the story gets confusing, because there's still a Minnesota Iceman exhibit on display at a place called Museum of the Weird in Austin, Texas. It's the one that was touring in the 1970s. And earlier this year, I had an opportunity to study it very closely with the ice melted down quite a bit. And it is, in fact, a latex model. Now, the question is, could there, in fact, have been an actual flesh-and-blood version of the Minnesota Iceman making the rounds in the late 1960s? And the owner, Frank Hansen, got into a little bit of trouble because the FBI, allegedly, and law enforcement became interested in the fact that he had a human-like thing that was dead in a block of ice, and he was charging people money to come look at it. So he disappeared for a few months and, by his own admission, had a latex model put together, a duplicate, he called it, and the original Minnesota Iceman, supposedly, he was going to put into storage. So to this day, we don't know. There are a lot of theories that whether it was just a latex model the whole time and these two scientists in 1968 were duped, or if this guy had the real McCoy, and because he was worried about the legal implications, he basically hid it somewhere and had the latex model made instead to kind of cover himself.
Interesting. So
it's a complex story, but I will say this. I examined the latex version, the new version, several months ago at length. I compared it to the extensive notes and measurements and photographs that were documented in 1968 of the original Iceman, and I found a number of dramatic differences in terms of the measurements, physical description, and the size. So I'm personally convinced, George, that there were two versions of the Minnesota Iceman. Now, one can debate whether the original was flesh and blood or latex. I doubt there were two latex versions. Apparently, the latex version was very expensive for this guy Frank Hansen to have made. So,
were there ever any reports of a creature like this being held at the Barnum and Bailey Circus?
Well, you have the JoJo the dog-faced boy type things. Starting with P.T. Barnum back in the 1800s, he had these humans with hypertrichosis, you know, the excessive hairiness
right
on display. I don't know if anything like this ever toured with any later circuses, but this thing was, you know, it's so weird that it was being shown at different carnivals and sideshows. It was like hiding in plain sight, if you will.
What about the little people that you have written about? But you call them savages.
The little people, yes. Littlefoot is a chapter I write about in my new book. And this is interesting, George. I think a lot of people have overlooked the possibility that in addition to Bigfoot, there might be a second sort of pygmy-sized or dwarf-sized version of relict hominid. And I've investigated similar creatures in Central America. Down there, they're known as the Duende, which is Spanish for goblin.
That's right, yeah.
And the descriptions are these little three-foot-tall, hair-covered creatures that walk on their hind legs. They have human-like faces. They're said to be very powerful. But we have similar legends around North America. When I was up in Alaska in 2015 filming a TV show, there were accounts of little people up there, and they were described identically, little hairy man-like creatures. People are very terrified of them, even more terrified than they are of Bigfoot, in fact. The native names are very hard to pronounce, but they are like Anukins, Urchin Rock, Jinxie Ock, so on and so forth. I've also interviewed some Native American people in the Dakotas that swear that their reservation has actually been overrun with these little hairy Littlefoot-type creatures. And, you know, again, there are many, many legends around the world that speak of little people, right? I mean, we instantly think of the, you know, the fairy lore of Europe and so on and so forth, but traveling all over the world, we have accounts of, you know, these little people are often described as being hairy and actually very primitive. And, of course, the notable thing is that in 2003, as you know, scientists discovered the fossilized remains of something called Homo floresiensis on an Indonesian isle. And this was a non-human species that stood about 3 feet tall and lived up until about 50,000 years ago, which is just really an eye blink.
That's remarkable. Jeez.
So I mean, something like Littlefoot, as I call it, did exist up until 50,000 years ago. So very similar to other fossil forms. One is called Homo habilis, which, again, was a little tiny 3 to 4 foot tall. Probably our earliest human ancestor came out of Africa and probably spread out all over the world. So, you know, I just wonder if there could, in fact, be a second type. And again, we were talking about the Yeti earlier, the smaller Yeti, a second type of relict hominid, something other than Bigfoot that's very, very small and perhaps also spread out all over the world.
That's a good point. We're going to come back and talk about the White Bluff Screamer. How about the Texas T-Rex? And we'll take phone calls with you next, Ken, on Coast to Coast AM.